So, good evening, everyone. Wonderful to see you. I missed you last week. I was not here. Maybe none of you were here either. So, we all missed each other and did other things. I don't know. I was on a retreat, so that's why I was not present. And I was on a retreat in Belgium, where my Dharma brother Frank Roshi was giving transmission for the second time to a woman, and the second time, and this time to a woman. His first successor is a man, a woman who is French speaking. As you probably know, Belgium has several languages, three actually. Flemish, French, and German. And Frank has, it's one sangha, but two distinct sanghas actually, because the French speaking are in the French speaking sangha and the Flemish speaking are in the Flemish speaking sangha. And there's not much crossover. And so I was in the part of Belgium that is French speaking, and I was quite moved by the person receiving the transmission and the sangha, and the woman who was receiving transmission, in the way that she's chosen to live her life. She's mid-60s, a mother and grandmother, psychotherapist. But has chosen, because for various reasons, her children are grown. One of them has died, and the other one has grown and has children of his own. Lives in created what is called la petite béguinage, and béguinage is a it exists in English, the word béguine. Basically, think of the ladies in Coimbra. I mean, there's only one now, Augusta. There used to be another one, and I don't know if there's others around, but it's women who have not renounced the worldly world, but have chosen to live in a spiritual way in community. And this originated in the 13th century in what is now the Netherlands and Belgium. And a bit in Germany, around the Rhine, near the Belgian and Dutch borders. And so these women, they were not in the traditional ones, that's basically 13th to 16th century. They were not nuns. They didn't take vows and retire from the world into a convent. But they were living a spiritual life in community with other women. And they were Christian for the most part. In fact, no, they were Christian, definitely. But so Fabienne, this woman in Belgium, she obviously received Zen transmission, so she's a serious Zen practitioner, but also has a longtime Christian Greek Orthodox practice. And the women, there are five of them who live together. One is more like her spirituality is ecology and environmental and farming and agriculture and plants and trees and things like that. One of them is a former nun who left the convent and lives with them. And her mother also lives there and had a long-time Christian practice. And the community changes. Fabien is the main person who lives there, but the others have come and gone over the years. And they live without a hierarchy. They all have an equal voice in what is happening in the community. They share cooking, so One day it's one person who cooks, the next day it's another one. And they have in the upstairs, in the attic of one of the buildings, they have a zendo, which when it's and then people can come from the outside and practice zen there. They also use it. It doesn't It's very simple space, and it has like a Buddha, some icons, Christian icons, various things in it. It's not strictly just Buddhist. But the reason I say that, this was very moving was it's because from all the aspects of their lives, from the broken pieces of their lives or the strings of their lives, it felt to me like a tapestry. And of course, tapestries are that same medieval time period, so maybe that's why that image came to me. But Fabienne's her daughter died 20 years ago when she was only 19, and that was a huge, huge thing. Other losses in the lives of the others, and they've made this beautiful space of practice together. And for me, it's like radically modern of living in spiritual community, women living in spiritual community, although it harks back to this medieval practice of béguinage, and it's even called La Petite Béguinage. And in the same village, Fabienne created a foundation in her daughter's name, which is a place where there are retreats, yoga practices. Anyone who wants to can rent the space and use it. And various practices come there regularly. And that's where the retreat was, where we were. And that too is very using whatever, it's just down the road in the same village, which was apparently a coincidence. They were looking for a place and that happened to be there. So, and using whatever they have in their lives, whether it's, painful loss or deep devotion or joy of sharing or attention to their, they do permaculture, is that what we say in English? I don't know. In the garden. And using everything as a manifestation of practice, something like that. And during this retreat, so there were a lot of people I didn't know. And someone came to me in Dokusan and said, asked the question, how can I deepen my practice? And I said, well, Zen is by nature fathomless. It's deeper than deep, it's wider than wide, vaster than vast, taller than tall. It's beyond. And the question is not so much how can I deepen my practice, but how can I realize that unfathomable depth of Zen? And as I told this person, when we say practice, what we're saying actually is we're practicing to realize this, realize that you're always in the heart of your own practice, your own life, and that practice and life are not other. that everything, and so Fabienne's community is a, you know, a manifestation of this. Everything is practice. That's what we need to realize. It's not about deepening or, you know, widening our practice or something. If we realize that you're always in the heart of your own practice, then the question of deep or small or tall or wide is no longer, right? And it so happens that Fabienne, this woman, her Dharma name is in French, Je suis la voie. I am the way. So this, of course, has Christian resonances. You know, Christ said this. At the same time, it's deeply Zen. It's nothing other than what I just said. You know, if you truly experience that you are the way, your practice is just beyond. There's nothing that limits it then in that case. Whatever arises is your practice. There was this And you know, that name, that Dharma name, Je suis la voie, I am the way, is kind of like a mirror or flip side of my Dharma name, which is Tu es cela, you are that. So, you know, the answer, the call and the response, you know, of, two ways of responding to who am I is I am the way and I am that, you are that. You know, not I am that, you are that. And this is like a koan. When I sit with that, those two Dharma names, and it's a real koan. And because it was, she was receiving transmission, I was, you know, sitting with what is transmission? Who is receiving, who is giving, and all of this. And so I was very present. What her name is, what Frank's Dharma name is, which is vue immédiate, which is direct view, immediate view, first view, you know, just what's right in front of you. And so what's right in front of you is you are that. I am the way. The unfathomable depth of you're right here is the heart of your practice, something like that. It was also very interesting too, because all of the chanting and everything was in French, but they've made some changes to it. And so I would, you know, think I'm going along and knowing the chant, and then suddenly the morning, you know, the verse of atonement in the morning, they changed the words. Or the thing that the Jikido says at night, the chant the Jikido says at night, they changed the words. The four vows were the same. Something else was different. No, I think that those were the two that, but that it, those are the things that, you know, we say all the time. We're so familiar with it. And then what? And that's interesting too. I don't know why they changed them. I don't know who changed them. I have a hard time believing Frank did that because he's not, I mean, he did everything in French, but he's not like a native French speaker. But maybe he did, I don't know. And that's always interesting too. So, can we say the same thing with different words? Of course we can. We can say the same thing with different words. Absolutely. In fact, I'm always saying the same thing with Dharma talks or whatever, but with different words. And I don't know what the person in Doku-san took from that exchange we had. I may never know, right? And it doesn't really, that's not why I say it, is so that I will see some result. I'm just meeting the person where they are, and that's what they brought. It was also very interesting, and this is all, this is important for teachers to be in this kind of situation because, so I'm there, I'm, a guest of honor because I'm Frank's Dharma sister, and I was, really helping so that all the ceremonies around the transmission went smoothly, and but at the same time, nobody's there for me, right? I'm a guest and everybody's happy I'm there, but that's not why they're there. And so I didn't have a Jisha, I didn't have an assistant with me. None of my students were there, right? Corinne had, my sister Corinne was there. Corinne Roshi was there as well. And her wife, who is not her student, but is one of Frank's students, was there. But she could kind of act as Corinne's Jisha and take care of Corinne, take care of Corinne. So nobody ever put a chair on my seat when I would come to sit, right? And that's really interesting. Like, well, of course they don't. They don't know that I want a chair, So I would ask for a chair. And then the person who was in charge of the Zendo, who I know actually that woman, she's from the Flemish speaking one, and really likes me and has known me forever and whatever. She did. She put a chair there. But then, they would clean the Zendo, or there would be a Dharma talk or Orioke or something. And then when I would come back, there was no chair there again. And this was really an interesting practice for me, So do I. Without giving the sense of being a prima donna, say, can someone please put a chair there for me? Or do I just ask every time for a chair? Or do I do it myself? So when I could, I just did it myself. But sometimes I was arriving late, everyone was sitting down, I didn't know where the chairs were, so I had to ask somebody to give me a chair. And this is a really interesting practice, to not be fixed anywhere. And when I told my husband, I came home and I told my husband this, and I was telling him about it. And he said, "Oh, that's terrible. One of your students should have gone with you, or Frank should have given someone to be a, why don't your students go with you? And Frank should have assigned someone to be your Jisha." And I said, "No, no. It's like, no, it's okay. It's okay." Very interesting experience because apart from that, I don't really need anything special, Corinne and her wife and I were had this little apartment that we were sharing, and so we made our own tea in the morning and did our own thing, and it was like there was no, I didn't need anything really. But this is like, okay, so whatever presents itself is my practice. So not having a chair in the Zendo was my practice. Now, can I make having a chair in the Zendo my practice too when we're in our retreats and everybody knows I need a chair, right? Or, the food was full of red pepper in this retreat. Whereas in our, and I forget all the time, because in our, in Wildflower, nobody cooks with red pepper because I can't eat it, But phew, nobody's cooking for me, right? And so that too is really interesting. I suppose I could have gone to the kitchen and I said, please make some food for me without red pepper, but I just put it on my spatula and gave it as the offering for the during karaoke. So it's very interesting to see how it's important, it's essential actually to go into situations that are not our usual way of being, chanting, sitting, whatever. You know, and even the language. So the Belgians, they speak French, but they have a few words that are different, right? You know, numbers, some of the numbers are different, different phrasing sometimes. And that too is really interesting to be displaced, to not, I was looking through one of my books today, looking for a text for our study group. And this is a book that I had, you know, we did it in the Donna study group like in 2004 or something. So I've had it for a long time. And there was a piece of paper in there that I had written some things on. And one of the things I wrote, and I don't know who said it, but I wish I did, because I didn't write who the quote was from. But it said, and the quote is, in having no past or future, in having, so in little quotes, just being here, the self falls away. The elusive self, you know, this the false self, has past and future. That self is afraid. That self knows fear. The self that has no past or future, that's just being here, in when we have no past or future, the self falls away. When we just are here, the self falls away. And you know, we can experience this moment to moment, maybe not even in terms of past and future, but we can, you know. So if I go there and they're chanting in a way that I'm not familiar with, if I just am with that, then I'm not thinking about how we chanted before. What was the past way of chanting? Just this. Or and then there's no self involvement there, because the self involvement is, oh, they're chanting differently, it should be the other way, or why are they chanting this way, or just something like that. Or the issue with the chair, you know, if I just if I can just drop that someone should give me a chair, and just stay with the experience of no chair. So once I did just sit on the cushions that were there, and it was horrible. It was 30 minutes before the Dharma talk, and the cushions were not good cushions. You know, good, I'm making a big judgment, but they were kind of flat and not very full. And I had to take off my jacket and roll it up and sit on it. And it was just excruciatingly painful for 30 minutes. And then I had to do a Dharma talk after that, sitting on the cushions. So, you know, at that point, I realized this is dumb. Why are you doing this to yourself? Just ask for a chair. And in that just asking for a chair, there's no self asking for a chair. It's just responding to what the situation is, responding to what the need is. In that moment, there was a lot of self in that. Well, I'll just sit on the cushion and, you know, bear, grin and bear it, you know. So all of this, these are just, I'm just like elaborating on what it is to see that you're always in the middle of your practice, you're always in the heart of it, whatever it is. And it's neither deep nor shallow. And also these, you know, I'm going back to the beginning of the women who live in their community, in their béguinage. That's what they're doing. It's just whatever it is, all the threads, all the pieces, are brought together. They're all included. Whether broken, whole, not even a question of broken or whole, you know. So maybe I'll stop there and see if anyone would like to share anything or questions, comments.
Thank you for the news, Roshi, because I know Fabienne and Frank, of course. Maybe I visited her place at one point, and I knew this was coming up, but I couldn't be something, it was impossible for me to think about going there. But I remember, what did she do? She copied for me. And I don't know what it was. It was a long verse from something that was very sweet. And it must have been in connection with something I had said to her, something from Buddhist context, several paragraphs. And I had it in my coat pocket for years that she had done this for me. That, and now I'm thinking maybe I got this all wrong. Do you know about Hilda de Bingen? Is that the way you say it? Now, is she called de Bingen because she was in a béguinage, or was her name used?
No, it's not actually the same. It's a
It's
different
not.
name. Yeah.
Oh.
Hildegard de Bingen. Bingen was the place where she was.
But that's not the root of béguinage. Because she was also in a, it was a béguinage, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I encountered her when I was going to Belgium, and just so many things. She made all these kind drawings of eggs and things in nature, and she was so attractive to me at the time. And one of the things that I think about every time I'm confronted with a tree, just about, not quite, but I think about her two or three times a week, is, if you look at green, it's good for your eyes. Now, I don't know if that's scientifically true or not, but since I have all these vision problems, whenever I'm looking out the train window at the trees going by, I think, thank you, Hilda. It makes me feel better in any case. So I'm really glad that Fabienne integrated another aspect of her practice in any case. I have to send a message.
I'm curious to know what was on the paper that you kept in your pocket all those years.
I can't believe I threw it out, because I remember it being almost threadbare when I got rid of the coat. I'm not even sure which coat it was. But it was, yeah, I'd be curious. I don't know. I can't remember the source. And it must have been about some complaint I had. This was sort of the answer to, this is the way you deal with this. Maybe if I kind of scratch around, it will come to me.
Yeah, I love finding papers in my books because I often do that. You know, I make a note on something and leave it in the book as a bookmark, and then I'm done with the book and I put it on my shelf, and then I pick up the book and it's like, oh wow, I wrote that on there in there. What, wow, that's interesting, you know, that piece of paper.
And I don't want to monopolize the conversation, but this business about the chair, not the chair. I think I may have told you this when it happened a couple of years ago during COVID, maybe. I decided that I had a fairly big trash can next to my sink, and I thought, this is not very attractive. We eat in my kitchen with friends. It's not very nice to have this great big trash can. I think I'll move it near the refrigerator where it's less obvious, but it had been there for 10 years. So, and it was in my head that it was there. So every time I'd clean some carrots, I'd plop the skins into the non-trash can since it wasn't there. But like for a week, every single gesture that anything that I had to throw away, I threw it away in the non-trash cans. Debbie, you have a Zen practice for crying out loud. Wake up. But it was just, the trash can is there. So I've learned, one of the things that I try to do, because it's easy when you get old and you're very comfortable in your environment, it's just everything, you know where it is. I can get to the bathroom in the middle of the night with my eyes closed. It's about move things around a little bit so I don't get too, I don't start throwing my carrot peelings on the ground, on the floor.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing it. Sharing this experience. It reminds me of what you were saying about the French, and it's funny because I mean, it's French, so you, it's a common language. And when we went to Germany for, and here I go, my memory fails me, Jin's transmission, and it was all in German. Remember that? And I don't think we even had booklets or anything. It was just this. And then for Bart in Holland also in Dutch. Dutch was easier actually than maybe not. But there's this feeling of knowing and not knowing at the same time of being yeah, feeling that everything is so familiar, yet you don't know. Yet it's the same thing. And it's like karaoke, it pushes you to really, really be present to just to follow, to be there. yeah, that was kind of a. And the chants weren't the same in Germany with Corinne. She introduced other chants and other rituals. And there was this tea ceremony in the morning, sort of tea ceremony when we were in the Zendo. That was with a little cookie. It's really it's a beautiful experience to just, yeah, be in those same differences.
Yeah, absolutely. Hello, everybody.
Diana.
I was thinking about what you said about not having a Jisha in this retreat. Once I spoke with Marlene about being a Jisha, and she I mainly remember this that she told me. Being a Jisha, is that the way you say Jisha? Is treating Roshi as one of us, something like that. She told me something like that.
And she said that you, Roshi, you appreciate that Ajisha doesn't feel that she that must treat you or in a special way or doing special things or but what I see is we tend to what I imagine because I've never been Jisha, but what I imagine and what I've seen the Jishas like Marlene I think we try to make special something special for you like for example, if you are in a farm with fruits, picking some fruits and fresh fruits and give them to you, or try to make well, something special because we feel good doing that.
Thank you for sharing this. It's really a service position, you know, that the Jisha, the assistant, of serving not only the teacher, but also serving the Sangha. And we do it, yes, because we care. We want to, you know, and we, it's not like a, I was my teacher Jisha for a long time, so I know this, I know it very well. You know, it's like responding to the person's needs. I mean, you become so attentive to the, you know what the person wants or needs, you know, with the teacher pretty much. You know, I mean, of course, they have to tell you, but you it's because you want to. Yeah, it's not like, you know, it's a duty or something like that. And so in the case of not having someone like that, and it's not that the teacher's anyone special, but because the teacher's doing a lot of other things, it helps to relieve some of the stuff that the teacher has to think about and do. But it can become really elaborate, you know, in the, you know. When I started becoming Jisha, you know, I would like help Roshi get her robes on. We had, there was a ritual in the Oriokhi that I don't know if Debbie would remember this, but where everyone would be standing with their bowls and Gena Roshi, the teacher, did not have her bowls, and the Jisha would come in and formally offer the bowls to the teacher and give the bowls to the teacher and then go back and sit down, and then we would begin. The bowls were not sitting by, the teacher didn't just bend over and pick up the bowls by, beside the seat like everyone, you know. A lot of this has been eliminated. And Gena Roshi didn't stop doing that after a while, too. But it was a pure joy for me to do it. And I understand that for the others it is. And yeah. So, yeah, thank you for bringing up the subject, Anna.
And for the jisha, that's a great teaching too, because it's just bringing tea, or there's nothing special actually of chit chat about what's going on. It's no deep profound, and that's a deep profound teaching, just that. Just drinking tea and sharing a cookie and discussing about what's going to happen next in the zendo or whatever. Simple, 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 so simple and so deep. Yeah.
And there are many, Bernie Glassman told me the first time I met him, and I was Gena Roshi's Jisha, he told me that in traditional Japanese monastic context, I think there are seven Jishas, and they each have a different function. And the highest one, the one with the highest function, was the jisha that was make would make the Roshi laugh, like the clown, the court jester kind of thing. And I don't know if this was his way of seeing, this young, like super zealous Zen student that I was at the time, and constantly, I followed my teacher everywhere and whatever, was his way of saying, I see where you are, but you have a ways to go. Listen up, I don't know if that's what it was. But I tell you, there are jishas who are, the first time I met Gena Roshi in a retreat, the jisha wouldn't let anyone near Roshi. If anyone tried to go see Roshi in her room, the jisha stopped her, stopped them. And Roshi didn't know this, actually. She didn't know that's what was happening until someone told her, and then she became very upset with the jisha for doing that. So, people have different ways of interpreting it. They're not supposed to stop people from seeing the teacher. No. But it's all practice, right? It's all
But
just.
if we want to see the teacher, we must say this to the Jisha first.
Yeah.
So,
Then the jisha is supposed to then tell the teacher that someone wants to see them.
yes.
But it's
So we are
very.
not supposed to.
Well, you can, of course. In my case, people can just knock on the door. The jisha is not standing outside the door, but blocking the door, which this woman was pretty much doing, actually. But it's true because, otherwise, because the jisha usually knows if the teacher is resting or they're busy doing something else, or when a good time would be for the person to come. So that's all that that is. Just kind of to help organize. It's not as a to be a a fence. It's to be more like a gatekeeper or something. But it's true in my case, people know that they can, I hope people know they can come and knock on the door if they want to.
In terms of the power thing, that's a big one, Trisha.
Absolutely. And that's why this person who I mentioned before was really abused. It was an abuse of power. With probably some kind of, justification that they were serving the teacher and protecting the teacher, I think. However, it was very also very self-involved of not wanting anyone else to be near her, kind of wanting to have her space alone with the teacher. Yes. Okay, well, if no one has anything else to share, we can stop here. Thank you.